This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. Was that bowl of soup you had today just right for the late winter? Preparing meals according to the seasons is part of the monastic life of my guest, Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette. He's a monk at Our Lady of the Resurrection Monastery in Millbrook, New York, where he gardens and cooks for the small group of monks who live there. Brother Victor has also made a name for himself in the secular world by publishing his recipes in a series of popular cookbooks. His latest has just come out in paperback, 12 Months of Monastery Soups. Brother Victor's first book, From a Monastery Kitchen, was written 20 years ago. That was followed by This Good Food, Table Blessings, and a book about monastery life called A Monastic Year. Brother Victor is responsible for preparing the meals at the monastery, so he called him on the phone before he had to go make lunch. I asked him why he organizes his cookbooks around the seasons.
You know, that's part of the monastic philosophy or the monastic way of life. We do everything in connected, you know, in connection with the seasons. Just to give you an example, you know, we are in the middle of Lent, or we just started Lent, and the music, the Gregorian chant, which we sing here, already changes to a different kind of music that is only used for Lent. The same thing with, you know, with our cooking. The cooking, it just tends to be a reflection of that general philosophy that we live in tune with the seasons. It has always been like that, and we find that it creates for us a very healthy rhythm. It creates the natural balance, the natural framework for our life. I think men and women are meant to be, you know, sort of integrated into the seasons and live in harmony with it, not against it. And so I think we do violence to our nature where we go against the natural rhythm of the seasons.
You write about the importance of soup and the role that soup has played in the history of monasteries. Take us back, if you can, to when monasteries really were soup kitchens.
Well, soup is a very ancient staple. It's also because it's something so basic, so very simple. I mean, you can throw anything into a pot of soup and make a soup. So for monks who sort of lead a life of simplicity and frugality, soup is just a very natural sort of daily staple. Now, during the Middle Ages or even earlier than the Middle Ages, very often when monasteries were situated in the middle of the center of the village, and when, you know, people were cold or didn't have enough to eat, or in times of famine or times of disaster, the people would just simply come and knock at the doors of the monastery at lunchtime and ask for a bowl of soup and for food in general, and the monks will provide them with a bowl of soup and some bread. So, and see, soup is just something that you can extend and make more of it to sort of feed others. With other kinds of food, it gets more complicated. And besides, take it, for instance, in the middle of the winter, if you're hungry, there's nothing more comforting than soup, because besides feeding you, it also gives you warmth. So it's a natural, I think, in monasteries. And so soup kitchens originated in that ancient practice that monasteries have of feeding the poor, those who knock at the doors when they were hungry or were in need of something.
Do you have something, a recipe that's a real pièce de résistance, that you know that when you serve this, you're literally pulling out the stops?
You're talking about soups?
Sure, soups. My favorite food.
Well, it still is, you know, we still sort of part of winter and going into spring. Maybe I'll speak of a soup that that we make around Christmas time. Actually, we make it for the Feast of St. Nicholas, and it's called St. Nicholas Soup, which is the 6th of December. And it's one of those recipes that I was just simply mentioning before, that it's just plain, simple winter vegetables, most of them root vegetables. And all you do is just boil them, bring them together. At the end, you pass them through through the blender, and you add simple cream to it, and then you reheat it, and, you know, perhaps add a little bit of butter, if you don't mind, a bit of fat in it. And it's a creamy, very creamy, but it's a very tasty, very delicious soup. Now, I have made that a couple of times for some groups like a William and Sonoma, for some displays and book signings, and also in Canada, because the book came out in French in Montreal. In both places, there was a tremendous, not just admiration, but tremendous response. And part of it is, I think, that the weather was cold and it hot soup like that. But I think it's also that they just were surprised that the simple, basic winter vegetables like turnips and carrots and potatoes and onions all blend together could create a kind of a taste.
Well, your cookbooks focus on simplicity, but I'm curious what you've got in your kitchen, because I think in a secular kitchen, we have many gadgets and machines that line all the counters. What do you have in your kitchen?
Well, you would be surprised. We do have some of those gadgets.
Oh, you do? Like what?
Well, we have a Cuisinart, and we have the standard thing to cut, vegetables, julienne style of any different style. That little machinery they call the mandolin, they call it. And so, and we have the different kinds of parts. We have also pottery parts that we used, for instance, for making cassoulet, in the oven that takes about 4, 5, 6 hours, of cooking. So we have the basic necessities. We may not have luxuries, but then we don't expect that in a monastery, but we have the basic necessities to do some kind of decent kind of cooking.
In your book, A Monastic Year, you talk about gardening as having a long monastic tradition. Describe the garden for us up there at your monastery in New York.
Well, we have several gardens, and they are not very big. We have a vegetable garden, which provides food for the table. That's close to the area where we have the barn with the sheep. And now we have a herb garden, which we use both for cooking, for drying, for making vinegars, and for different medicinal purposes, for tea, etc. And that's very traditional in the monastery, to have a herb garden. Then we had several flower gardens, both perennials and annuals. In our way of gardening, it's sort of, we look at the property and we see what we like to create, an enclosure of peace, a place that is just sort of appealing and sort of lift up our hearts and our minds in prayer and praise to God. So our gardening methods are very simple. We see what the land calls for, and we sort of just add or trying to blend with it. We don't really try to change so much the contour of the land. So it's a very natural kind of gardening. Lots of perennials just that have been planted throughout the years and come out in certain areas, and then they add, we add some annuals for colors, every year, which we use lots of the flowers for decoration, for flower, arrangements for the chapel. And then throughout the years, the bulbs have naturalized, so we have thousands and thousands of bulbs of daffodils in the spring, daffodils and other things scattered throughout the whole property. So in a lovely spring morning, it's just wonderful to walk and to see this display of color that seems just to grow naturally in the places. It's not a very cultivated garden, because it's a very simple property, but it has the appeal of looking very natural, very just in the right place.
Now, I know that you sell your vegetables and probably your herbs, maybe even your flowers at a local farmer's market. Mm-hmm. Do they have to get used to you having a stall there and selling along with local farmers?
It was quite a surprise, I think, at the beginning. First of all, I was already known in the area. So when they first saw me appearing there with some other things, it was a surprise. But it became very popular. Unfortunately, this past year, we have to cut that activity simply because I couldn't manage that and manage to write the books. I was asked by Doubleday to write two books for them. So I signed a contract for two books, and it was just impossible. So one of the things that have to be relinquished, unfortunately, was the farmers market. But we still sell a certain amount here in the monastery. We have a very small shop that's just open mostly to the people that come here on retreat. And so the things that we make here, including some of the jellies and some of the jams and vinegar and some of the pickles, etc., and the dry herbs, and we put them there, and the people still buy them.
One thing you write about is when it comes to selling your produce is to avoid greed and to make sure that you're not charging too much. Is that something that transaction, is that difficult for a Benedictine monk?
Well, that's part of the rule. That's part of the wisdom of Saint Benedict. Saint Benedict trying to keep everything imbalanced, and that the monk could fall for greed just like anybody else, and will want to receive more for his work, like any other worker. But Saint Benedict makes us mindful that we are spiritual. Our purpose in the monastery is a spiritual life, and we need to earn our living. He does say that we need to earn our living by the work of our hands, so we have to work. But we just must. Our aim is to make ends meet and not to go beyond or further than that. So to me, it's a very contemporary advice that's full of value, full of wisdom.
Our guest today on Fresh Air is Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette, and he's written a number of books about gardening and about cooking, making soups, including A Monastic Life, 12 Months of Monastery Soups, Table Blessings, This Good Food. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about cooking, gardening, and the monastic life with Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette. I'm curious, as you make that transition from monastic life into the secular world, if you're going on a book tour, for instance, or you're making a television appearance, how do you prepare yourself to go out into this noisy, hurried world?
You know, I don't know if I can really prepare myself. I find it every time I do it, it's a penance for me. I find it tedious. I went, you know, this past November, I have to go to Canada to do quite a bit of promotion for the book because they concentrated on 3 days. And they have me do 4 television stations and 15 radio interviews and I don't know how many newspaper interviews and then book signings. And I was going on from 7 o'clock in the morning until midnight. I was absolutely exhausted. I just wanted to escape and get back here.
That's the author's lament, I think.
Whenever I do, you know, I've done QVC a few times, and I've done, CBS and a couple of other television things, and I always get a request. We're doing the Discovery Channel at the end of the month. I'm always, when I go to do those things, I look at it as, you know, I enjoy a certain amount of it, but to me it's a penance. I'm always looking forward to coming back to our quiet and to our silence.
Well, speaking of silence, you have an interesting chapter in your book, A Monastic Year, about silence, and it's more than not speaking. You write, "The habit of silence among monks does not apply only to speech or conversation. Monks are encouraged to practice quiet in many ways, such as avoiding making noises while they walk, sit, work, close, or open a door or a window." And we must be a very noisy world for you.
Yes, and silence becomes a habit. You grow into it, you know, as a monk in a monastery. So you need the whole milieu, the whole atmosphere, the whole, that must speak of quiet. Because silence helps us to live in harmony with everything that is around us, that is within us and is around us. And so there's not this dichotomy. When you go outside, you notice that silence is not a value, but then outside we are not always, you know, sort of encouraged to live in harmony with our inner world and with the things outside of us. And so it's not necessarily a value. I wish it were. I think all of us can benefit from silence, because silence to me is a school where you learn things. You know, it teaches you about yourself in a way that you never learned otherwise, unless you take time to be quiet with yourself. It teaches you about others. It teaches you about nature. It teaches you about God. It teaches you about, you know, surrounding the gardens, the animals we have. It teaches you about everything. I mean, for instance, just to read a good book and to appreciate in depth, you have to do it in silence. You can't do it in a noisy thing, because you cannot really penetrate the depth of, you know, of learning that is in the book unless you can sort of be quiet. So silence, it becomes a habit in a monastery, in a monk throughout the years, and you are comfortable with it. And the moment is that you are out of it, it's like a fish, you know, out of water. You just simply don't know how to swim.
Well, when you're on a hurried 3-day book tour and they have you booked from morning till midnight, yeah, have you learned how to tune out some of that silence, or you just wait till you get back to the monastery and then?
No. You know what I try to do is, you respond to what is there, what you're being asked, but every moment that you can be quiet and you're allowed, you know, that you're free to sort of not to say anything, you enter back into your own heart and make quiet there and just be yourself, you know, comfortable as much as you can be in the middle of the crowd, just being quiet there yourself, you know, just being tuned in to your own inner self, to your own inner life, and sort of I think it's possible. I don't think it's the kind of thing that you want all the time, but it's the only way that you can sort of survive a situation like that. And so I may be in the middle of a crowd, in the middle of a television thing, and I can still be quiet because I just simply feel comfortable being comfortable with myself innerly, you know, within. And so I retreat myself to my own inner being.
Do you eat differently when you're away from the monastery?
We usually have a very simple principle in monastic life that you eat what is presented to you at the table. I mean, if we really practice simplicity, we should not be complicated. So what is presented to us, this is what we usually eat. I prefer, and I try to, if possible, to sort of stick to vegetarian principles whenever possible and to healthy habits. But I also want to please those who invite me or those who are kind enough to serve us something. So I, partake of whatever they present to us in that. We're trying to be not to fuss too much about ourselves, when we are in the monastery or when we're outside the monastery. So it's what is presented to us, unless it's something that's very unhealthy, which is seldom the case.
Yeah.
We just accept it with gratitude and take it and eat it.
Are you ever tempted by a gooey chocolate cake or something really sinful like that?
Of course. I think that's absolutely human, absolutely normal. Who doesn't?
And do you give in or do you resist?
Well, I mean, if it's presented kindly to me, I take it as a gift from the Lord and delight in it and eat it. I won't go and seek it myself, but if this is what someone who invites me, presents me at the table, and if we're eating in a restaurant, that's part of the dessert, I don't think I should necessarily have to choose the worst, thing. I mean, there's no reason why we cannot choose the more tasty or the better things. But, you do with simplicity. You take it or leave it. You do it then, and then, freeing after the next time, you're back home, you don't think about it. I mean, you can think and enjoy that you had it, but you don't depend on that, You sort of keep your own. To be innerly free is to sort of take and accept things that they are and not to become attached to them.
You've written a number of books, and I'm curious how that first book got written, whether someone approached you to write a book or whether this was something that came from you.
No, I never intended to write any book. I never thought about it. It never entered my mind. It just happened to be that when we first arrived here, we were looking for land to buy to build our monastery. We didn't have any means because we were not funded by any large monastery, or we were not helped by foundations or by the diocese or by anybody. So we have to sort of raise our own funds ourselves. And there was a wonderful Quaker professor that used to come often to our monastery, Elise Boulding, who said to us, he said, "Well, why don't you write down your recipes, and we'll do a cookbook with that." And she had this idea and contacted HarperCollins at that time. It was Harper Row at that time. And then they sort of, we said, "Well, we'll take a chance and we'll see." So they printed 5,000 copies for the first book. That's 20 years ago. And it sold out in a month. And so they kept reprinting until, that was from a monastery kitchen that it sold about, 100,000 copies. Then was out of print, and now he's been reprinted again, which is the book you have probably. And so that's really the genesis of how the book started. And then, one thing led to another. They asked me to write another book and a third book, and now they're asking me to do two books at a time.
Now you're a famous book author.
I never intended to write a single book. I mean, as I said, I just intended to live as a plain, simple monk without having to do any of this. I didn't even know that I had writing skills. I have to sort of develop by working on them.
But you're happy you did it, I assume?
Well, yes, there's a joy in them. To me, the joy is that we share something of the monastic life or the monastery with the outside world. That's really, it's not so much making money. It's not so much, I do also enjoy writing recipes, creating new things. I think it's a creative kind of work. But I also like to see that the monastery somehow goes out into the world through these simple means of books, that we share part of our life with others, and we bring perhaps a little bit of message of life of simplicity and peace and joy. And sort of, I get lots of letters from people, from around the country. And they sort of feed me, and they give me a great joy knowing that the book touches them.
Are you afraid at all that monastic life will die out? That you'll be the last of a breed of monks?
Well, it's, you know, speaking from the natural point of view, it's always possible. I do think, however, that monastic life is something that transcends cultures. You know, you find Buddhist monks, you find in all cultures, you find, you know, Zen Buddhists, you find Hindu monks, you find Sufi monks, you find Christian monks, Catholic monks, you know, Orthodox monks. So I think in the province of God, there will always be people called to monastic life, but what are monks are those who are in the quest, in search for the absolute, for God. And so I think that's part of I think, you know, all human beings have within themselves a call to the absolute, perhaps not always to live the monastic life in a full sense, but I think there will always be people who have the call for that absolute, the thirst for the absolute. You know, perhaps we may be fewer and sort of less and less, but I don't think it will die out completely, and I trust God that He will always have, you know, people that He will be calling, and that to live in union with Him, and to sort of to make witness of this, that there's more to life than just, you know, the ephemeral terrestrial things, that we have, you know, we are called to something higher, into something deeper, which is, you know, the thirst for God. So I don't think it will die out. I'm not too worried about it. I think God can take care of Himself and can take care of the rest of us too.
Brother Victor, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's author, cook, and gardener, Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette. His book, 12 Months of Monastery Soups, has just been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air.